The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello, and welcome to That's Life, Spectator Life's sideways look at the world today. I'm Benedict Spence.
And I'm Andy Shaw.
And on this podcast, we'll be poking fun at the people, words, and ideas that have popped up in the news over the last few weeks. Our guest for this episode is award-winning comedian Leo Kearse. Leo recently tweeted his admiration for the Manchester United footballer Marcus Rashford after he successfully persuaded the government into a U-turn on free school meals. This made him the most successful public lobbyist of the government since Joanna Lumley, and I think he probably deserves some sort of recognition, naming a building after him or perhaps a statue somewhere. Leo, it's great to have you with us. How have you been making the most of your newfound freedom now that lockdown is slowly, tentatively beginning to end?
Well, I was stuck in Australia for most of it, and I've come back now, and instead of making the most of my newfound freedom, I've got a newfound having to wear a face mask, newfound like not being able to go to the pub. There doesn't seem to be a lot of freedom. It's not even nice weather. The Australian winter was better than like the British summer. So I wish I'd stayed in Australia, frankly, where everything's open and you can go to comedy clubs, you can earn money. It's brilliant.
Yeah, well, I don't know why you came back, really, Leo. I know when you were in Australia, you were shooting videos on the beach.
Yeah.
Back to us in the UK, everyone in lockdown. And you put a compilation together called Wankers Loving Lockdown, which was just, I thought was really hilarious.
Wankers Loving Lockdown. You just put this video out on the internet, and this is just... Do you want to explain what this is? Is it about onanism, or
no,
is it something a little more...
It's just about all the people who are having a great time during coronavirus, because obviously environmentalists are loving it, because the petrol for the boats and stuff is cheaper. And all these people, there's just so much. I mean, the Black Lives Matter protest was almost a welcome palate cleanser, because all these people were moaning. Everybody was moaning on Facebook, being like, oh, my neighbours having a barbecue, and I think there's five of them in the garden. We should have phoned the police. It's all these guys with no chins. I noticed that there's a trend, guys with no chins complaining about their neighbours having a barbecue. Like, you should have phoned the police. Like, no, don't phone the police. Honestly, you should fucking boil your head in some concrete, man. Like, this is, geez, we don't need you in the...
Well, that's good. I was worried that if any of our listeners were going to just type into Google wankers during lockdown, that something awful would come up. But actually, yeah, this is quite reassuring that it's just a compilation of the worst human beings on earth. Well, Leo, there's an awful lot to get our teeth into over the last couple of weeks. What's been happening with statue toppling and book burning of Harry Potter being cancelled and what have you. So out of all the myriad things that you could choose, has there been one moment that's kind of stood out for you?
Yeah, I mean, the moment for me that certainly made me feel the most, don't know if it made me feel the, definitely didn't make me feel the best, but the Nazi salutes at the riots were, the protests were really shocking. And, like, I haven't seen Nazi salutes outside of a Hollywood film, like, ever, I think. And so that was a real, like, it was a kick in the guts. And actually, I'd recorded some videos about how the people defending the war memorials weren't Nazis, because why would Nazis defend war memorials to people who defeated Nazis? But then seeing the Nazi salutes, I was like, oh my God, you guys have ruined that video. You know what I mean? This is material I can't put out. So they've wasted my time. They've wasted their own time. No, it really was. I mean, I think it's quite a scary moment. Everybody seems to be glossing over it and not worrying about it. But I mean, I think there's a real danger that all this sort of constant just whittling away at, or certainly what will be perceived as a constant whittling away at white British culture is just going to feed into the far right and inflame the far right and, you know, give more power to people like Tommy Robinson. So all the cancelling TV shows, I know it's all done for the, you know, they do it for supposedly good reasons, but it just makes some white British people feel that their culture's being eroded. Desecration of war memorials, you know, this is stuff that's not going to win over middle England. It's just going to push people further to the right, I think.
Mm. You know, I think most people are not racist. And also most people are not anti-racist. They just like treat people as individuals and get on with life. And, you know, a lot of people have got, you know, families with a mixture of races, work with people. It's just, you know, treat people as individuals. And I thought we got to a really, really good stage. And it does feel like people are just being pushed in the face. You know, white privilege, you know, being white is bad, you know, you need to take sides. And it feels like there's a real pressure pushing your face. And it comes to a point where people are just saying, bugger off, you know, just stop making me feel bad.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think the big danger is it does push a section of people to a sort of fairly far-right solution. And we haven't seen that in this country for a long, long time. I mean, you know, the far-right in British politics has been a sort of, you know, a ragged rump. I remember when we went over to see a couple of games during the Euros in 2016, and we met a lot of the England fans who'd come up from Marseille. And I don't know if you remember that, but they were absolutely trounced by the Russian ultras who, you know, are a bunch of fascists who drill in the woods and, you know, they operate military style. And the British fans were just like, you know, just pissed and ran away and you know, got absolutely lumped.
Yeah.
So even the sort of like far right who might go on tour with the football team were just like just an absolute rump.
Well, yeah, I remember when that happened, I was reporting for TalkSport. Because I love watching football hooligans fight each other. I think it's far more entertaining than any game of football is ever going to be. Like, if a fight breaks out a football match, everybody turns around and watches the fight. Nobody is like, wait a minute, this is really good football, I'm going to ignore this fight. But yeah, the Russian approach to their football hooligans, they train them. They get like military training and like combat gear and stuff. That's what Putin does. We lock ours up. And as a result, we get embarrassed overseas. You know, we've got these like fat plonkers who've never been in a fight in their lives going over there drinking 12 cans of Carling and then like getting their heads kicked in. Like, no way, we need military training for our hooligans. We need them, you know, if they're going to rock, if they're going to destroy a French town centre, we need them to do it, you know, really carry the flag for us.
It's yet another example of British soft power being eroded. It's the inability of our hooligans to hold
it's
their
own. It's the last vestiges of the empire, you know.
Well, in the old days, it used to be like young lads and they'd shave off all their hair and they, you know, and all that. Now, the guys don't need to shave their head because they're bald. They're bald old fat blokes who are incapable of fighting if they wanted to.
They're the luckiest people in lockdown. They don't need barbers. I found it rather shocking. But on the other hand, there was something that I found almost slightly reassuring, because even though you don't like to see the far right turning up and in any sorts of numbers in central London, it was reassuring quite how stupid many of them seem to be, because we've heard for a very long time that, you know, Brexit is going to unleash the far right. The far right is on the march across the UK. And then we have a Black Lives Matter demonstration, and you think, right, well, if I were a really stupid member of the far right, I'd probably then tear across London and look for police to start fighting. And everybody's kind of thinking, well, if far right is dangerous and organised, that's the last thing they'll do. But what was the one thing they did do? They all turned up, they got drunk, and they picked a fight with, by this stage, very heavily armed police. So at the very least, we can all safely assume that there's not going to be a far right taker of this country, because they're completely incompetent.
Well, it didn't seem to stop Boris Johnson.
Ah.
there is one group that have got a real interest in the far right being a threat, which is, you know, the sort of Antifa lot, because, I mean, by definition, you know, they're called anti-fascists. And if there aren't any fascists knocking about, then they just have to go and make a cup of tea. You know, I do think there are, you know, a section of people who, you know, look to the, you know, 1936 defence of Cable Street, you know, the heroic fight during the Civil War against the Falangists in Spain, you know, even the fight against the National Front in the late 70s. That's an inspiration for people. And they'd love it again. They'd really love it again. So they've got a real, you know, they would like this to be a threat, because then they can get, sort of be the heroes and defenders. And I think, disappointingly for them, the sort of rabble that the far right is isn't really going to provide that threat that they can heroically defend society against.
Just very quickly before we move on, what do you think of the government's response to it, actually? Because, you know, there's been a lot of complaints that it's been rather weak, the response to both the problems that we saw with the Black Lives Matter demonstration and then the fact that the far right turned up in London and caused a bit of a ruckus. You know, it doesn't seem to have been handled especially well.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite transparent, the sort of much more, you know, stringent authoritarian crackdown on the people defending the war memorials, or the far right people, which, to be honest, you know, I think is fair enough. I mean, I think the government's in a tricky place, because it's got to try and appear to be doing the right thing, but also not alienate too many, you know, too much of Middle England who don't want to see war memorials desecrated. So yeah, they're in a tricky position. And I think some of the language this week, like Dominic Raab saying that, you know, kneeling comes from Game of Thrones, being flippant like that, that's almost like a dog whistle to people who might want to hear that. And I think, even though it's, you know, it sounds like a bit of a mean thing to say and a bit sort of flippant towards Black Lives Matter, it's you know, it's quite an essential thing to keep those voters somewhere in the centre instead of pushing them out to the far right.
Andy, Has there been anything particularly momentous that has stood out for you? I mean, it would have to be to take away from what's been happening in London for the last few weeks.
Well, it's the protest that's become effectively a free festival in Seattle, which I think is just... I've been watching it with total fascination. It's called the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ. Actually, it's got another name because it's already split, or the Capitol Hill Occupation Protest. So it's six blocks in the centre of Seattle, which is one of the world's wealthiest cities. I think Boeing's headquartered there, Amazon headquartered there, Starbucks, Microsoft. And it just seems that, you know, the unemployed middle class of Seattle have just effectively set up a free festival for themselves on the back of the Black Lives Matter protests. So I don't know how sort of, you know, taking over the centre of Seattle and setting up no-cop cooperatives and conversation cafes and listening to music actually is going to do anything to solve racism. But it's been a real fascination. They've set up a conversation cafe where they're discussing about how they enact decolonization. And funnily enough, they do actually sell probably the most white supremacist coffee going, which is the skinny soy latte. and they haven't discovered the irony that, you know, they should perhaps decolonize themselves before they start preaching to everyone else. But it's amazing. It really reminds me of Stonehenge Free Festivals, all the free festivals that used to happen in the early 80s in the UK. And then you dress it up as if it's a protest about transforming society. There is one thing that's quite interesting. There's a whole series of demands. Some of them have got some, you know, quite a lot to do with racism and the police, but there are loads of others. One of them is to stop the gentrification of Seattle. And you think, well, actually, you know, you've achieved it. I mean, you've just spray painted all the buildings. You've just turned all the local parks into toilets. It's like you've done it. You've achieved your own demand. It's probably the one thing that they will achieve throughout this is degentrifying the centre of Seattle. I don't know, have you seen this, Leo? Have you seen this?
Yeah. I've never understood why people don't like gentrification. Like, it means somewhere is getting nicer. You know, it means you can get nice coffee and you don't get mugged. If you miss shit coffee and getting mugged, you can move to Glasgow. You know what I mean? Like, just gentrification is good. I've never understood why people are like, oh no, this place is getting nicer. I saw these cop-free, like police-free zones, which is surely crying out for some criminals to go in and just start knocking heads together and taking Apple MacBooks. I just, you know, all these people, defund the police. I mean, for a start, that's a Tory policy. Defunding the police is a Tory policy, right? You know, they're trying it with the NHS, they're trying it with every public service. It's never traditionally been seen as like something that improves the service. I mean, I think if aeroplanes were falling out of the sky, you wouldn't immediately be like, oh, we need to defund the maintenance teams. You know, but yeah, defunding the police is going to be the solution to crime, apparently. So yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of these people are saying defund the police. If the police weren't there, their heads would be being used as ashtrays by larger people. They'd be hunted for meat. You know what I mean?
There's... by Russian football hooligans.
Yeah. Putin-trained Russian football hooligans.
So Leo, our regular listeners know that we're working on a dictionary of genre-defining words, era-defining words, things that have already caught the attention. Words that have come to mean different things. And we were just wondering if you might have a word or a phrase that, you know, really, really speaks to you, that, you know, sums up the times that we live in. Something that, you know, if you were to think 2020, what's the first thing that would think, you know, you'd think of in this era, exactly?
I think right now, I'd say racist, because it's a word that its meaning seems to be changing on an hourly basis. Certainly, you know, a few years ago, racist meant somebody who's racist, who discriminate against people based on, you know, the colour of their skin, their race or whatever. And now it just means everybody who hasn't worked out the very convoluted woke algorithm that allows you to not be racist. There's basically no way for a white person to not be racist at the moment. I mean, I've seen some of my black friends are posting on Facebook saying white people need to speak up in support of Black Lives Matters. Other black friends are posting saying this is time for white people to shut up and listen. So either way, I'm not doing the right thing. You know, this is a very difficult time for me. I've noticed a lot of white people are actually capitalising on this. They're writing books. There's a bit, I can't remember what it's called, but is it called How to Talk to Black People? There's some sort of, you know, really patronising, horribly woke name, like How to Talk to Black People or something. And basically, in the old days, it was great. If you're talking to somebody with a different ethnicity, you just didn't worry. You just treated them the same, or, you know, at least tried to. You know, if you've newly arrived from rural Scotland, you know, you might be, you know, like, you might ask them questions, but, you know, after that, you sort of like, get used to it, and then you just treat everybody the same, and that seemed to be a good system. And now, you know, people are writing these books, you know, saying you've got to microanalyze all your interactions with people of different ethnicities to identify where you might be doing something that might be perceived as woke, not just now, but in 5 years' time, and the rules have changed again. Like, number one, this is white people writing books, making money off white people's guilt. You know what I mean? That money's not going to, like, black people. Number two, I hardly think that the thing that's going to help this situation is white people having more of a stick up their arse when they're talking to black people, you know? I think, if anything, we need to just try and relax a little more and treat everybody the same. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about you, Andy. There is something slightly concerning about a white author writing a book on racism, because it sort of suggests that they're sort of saying to you, and I should know, it doesn't exactly reassure you.
It's not just the authors, but also the writers of the dictionaries are now redefining what racist means in the dictionary. So you might have seen that Merriam-Webster thing in Canada, where the original definition of racism was, you know, treating people based on their race, colour of skin, ethnicity and what have you. And it's been redefined. Firstly, explicit institutional bias against people because of their race. And secondly, a broader implicit bias that can also result in an asymmetrical power structure. So it's not something you can even tell or understand. It's implicit.
Yeah.
And you can never, you know, unless it's explicit, how do you know it's happening? So it's almost like you will not be able to prove that you're anti-racist. I mean, it's hard enough to do it anyway, because if you're accused, I mean, it's the worst thing you can accuse someone of is that sort of bigotry.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to defend against. But when it's also about something that's implicit and sort of undercover, it's going to be really, really hard. And you just think, well, what's that going to happen? If that happens with racism, is it going to happen with every single word is going to be redefined? So a woman, you know, will be redefined as someone who wants to be one and is suffering from patriarchy. That'll be the definition of a woman. So you've got to get some element of the power structure in there, and also the level of choice.
Well, it's interesting, this sort of implicit thing. Everybody's implicitly racist, and we've got to constantly atone. I mean, at least with Catholicism, you only had to atone on Sundays. You know, now we've got this constant Catholicism. You've constantly got to be atoning. You're never going to be free of your sin.
It sent me straight back to the church. At least I had routine with Catholicism.
Yeah. And you got a wafer.
I knew where I stood.
You got some wine and a wafer. Don't even get wine and a wafer with these pricks. You know?
You can buy some indulgences, though. I think that's the way forward, is buying indulgences. It's quite interesting, actually, this CHAZ, this Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. There was a video that came out a couple of days ago about, there was a speaker, big crowd of people, and it's a mixture of sort of white, black people in the crowd. And the speaker was black, and he said, you know, white people need to show that you're going to put things right. And in fact, what you can do now is take $10 out of your pocket and give it to a black person. And that's what they did. And it was just, I was just, really? What are you going to do someone who's, you know, sort of, you know, biracial or mixed race, or you know, somebody who's Korean? I mean, how does that work? It's like, it's going to, well, you get $7.50, and actually, I'm going to give you a bit of change. And you know, it's like, it's going to get really, really confusing.
That's amazing. Oh, my God. But it is, I mean, it's scary at the moment, because, I mean, a lot of, you know, it's quite a febrile atmosphere, and there almost seems to be the start of a sort of McCarthyist witch hunt in the arts against anybody who doesn't have the right opinions. I was talking to a filmmaker yesterday who's been kicked off a project because she didn't message the producer of the film asking what she could do to support black people. Even though, you know, why would the producer help her? Why would she be able to help the producer help black people? That's not clear. And also the producer was angry because she tweeted being critical of the looters burning businesses. And the producer said, you know, these businesses, they're owned by banks and stuff, so they don't, you know, it's a valid form of protest.
So it's all right.
But she lost a job because of that, because of her opinion. And she didn't have any opinion that, you know, was particularly unreasonable or, you know, couldn't be supported. It was, you know, basically she supports Black Lives Matter. She just doesn't support the rioting, the looting. And she didn't, you know, explicitly email the producer asking what she could do. But for her to be, you know, fired like that is scary. I think that's the sort of thin end of a wedge that's, I mean, certainly in comedy, people are so desperate to be woke, so desperate to be right on. You know, people are going to lose work over this.
It's frightening at two levels. One is because it does nothing to solve genuine instances where, you know, black people, you know, have worse life chances, don't have the same opportunities, where there may be genuine discrimination. So the real world of, you know, of work, of education, you know, real life. And it's all being transported into culture. So it's all about, well, let's address it in the cultural sphere, which is just how we talk to each other, how we communicate, how we understand ourselves. And it's a real displacement activity because it lets people off the hook, but it then just controls people's behaviour. And that can get more and more out of control because, you know, all you do is control more and more behaviour. You don't actually solve real problems.
So, Andy, have you got a word that you want to add to racist this week?
Well, I'm afraid it slightly leads on from it, which is systemic. I keep hearing the term systemic said all the time. So people say, you know, the George Floyd killing is barbaric, but what do you want to, you know, do in the UK? Well, I want to solve systemic racism. And then when people are asked, well, what does that mean? They don't really have an answer. They either dive into the past and talk about something that happened a couple of hundred years ago with slavery, or they go off into the realms of culture and what have you. And it's just a little bit like how a doctor trying to make sense of a problem, how they would deal with it. Because actually systemic, from a medical term, means it affects the whole body. You know, it affects all the organs. And you can just imagine a situation where somebody goes to see a doctor and the doctor says, well, what's wrong with you? Yeah, like, today I woke up feeling really poorly because of the system. How? Well, nothing seems to work properly. Just be specific. Well, I just feel really run down. It's like, what do you actually mean? You know, society is really sympathetic to try and sort things out. But when it's a sort of a cultural attack, it puts people on the defensive.
Well, anyway, finally, events, words, ideas, these things ultimately only matter when there are people involved. So, Leo, is there an individual who stood out for you over the current crisis over the last few weeks?
Yeah, I think Patrick Hutchinson. So he was the Black Lives Matter protester who saved one of the other side, somebody who might have been far right, I mean, we don't know for sure, but he was certainly, you know, a white guy who's there to, you know, ostensibly defend the war memorials and possibly do some Nazi salutes. We don't know for sure. But yeah, he saw him being beaten up and on the ground, and he slung him over his shoulder and saved him, which I thought was a remarkable moment. And, you know, probably did a lot to make people feel a lot better about this and feel that, you know, both sides could see that there's, you know, it's not just a complete battle. There's people on the Black Lives Matter side that, you know, didn't want this guy to be killed and saved him. So yeah, I thought that was quite a sort of inspirational moment. Also sort of, you know, showed some of the complexity of the issue, because, I mean, he saved him, but he was also wearing combat gloves. So it's not like...
yeah.
He might have been ready to punch him in the face if he wasn't already on the ground. I don't know. But yeah, I thought he was great. And like, he looks great. I think he should be the next James Bond. He, like, you know, he's tall, he's good looking. You know, I think it's time with a black British James Bond. I think that would bring the country together.
Yeah, it was fantastic, that, wasn't it? It was in an interesting place as well, wasn't it, where it took place? Because it was on the South Bank and it looked like it was near Festival Hall. And in fact, if you look at the photographs in the background, the only statue that's nearby is the Nelson Mandela bust. So I was thinking, what on earth was going on? It's a bit weird.
Yeah.
I'm sure he wasn't defending the Nelson Mandela bust against the Black Lives Matter.
Was he heading
to...
really
confusing situation.
I think he was heading to Waterloo, possibly, to leave. So, you know, he might have been picked off as he left.
It's come out, I don't know if you've noticed, but it's come out recently that he was a Millwall fan.
And a former police officer.
And there's now a former police officer, yeah. But I thought it was fantastic. Patrick Hutchinson just did absolutely the right thing. And yeah. Either it was just going too far and he just thought, hang on, we've made a point, you know, save this guy, or whatever. But it was a real act of humanity. Because you could see the photos in the lead up to it. It wasn't a stampede. You know, there are about 30 or 40 people around, you know, having a go at this guy, kicking him, punching him. Some, you know, guy trying to stub a cigarette out on his head.
Yeah.
And it's getting really, really nasty. So, yeah, it was a beautiful, beautiful moment in amongst the melee.
And could have saved what could have kicked off a, you know, entirely new situation. If that guy, Bryn Mael, if he'd been killed, I mean, you can imagine the, you know, the schisms in the country. Is that how you say it? Schism or schism? Schism.
Schism?
Schism.
Schism.
Schism in the country.
Say, have you lied?
I haven't used that word in a while.
There's a schism in the room as to how you pronounce the word.
Schism.
That was a schism.
Well, that's quite nice, actually. That's a positive individual. It's not every week, every episode that we have a positive thing. Andy, are you gonna double down on that? Is your person who you're going to talk about a positive influence, or you're just going to tear it all down for us?
I think it's a wait and see with mild trepidation. So the guy I think to look out for is Tim Davey, who's going to be the new BBC Director General, who's coming in September. But I think he is going to have his work cut out. And I hope I really hope he knows how to save the BBC and how to make it the organisation it really could be. My fear is, because he's got the sort of whole marketing thing, is it's all about how do you produce stuff that can be sold abroad. And it's basically more and more BBC dramas shunted out. And I remember John Plowman, the old comedy commissioner, saying they invest far too much in dramas and don't invest anything in comedy. You know, there are no sitcoms on the TV at the moment. You know, where are the sketch shows? It just tends to be panel shows and, you know, sort of Live at the Apollo stuff. And actually, you know, foreign audiences love British comedy. You know, if you speak to Germans and Swedes and Americans and French people, they absolutely love British comedy. And I sort of fear that the sort of bland, safe, precautionary, principle approach and what can you very easily package and market abroad is probably the direction that the BBC is going. You know, it's probably going to be the last chance to save it. Sorry, that was a very serious point. I can't think of any other jokes to make about it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the BBC needs more, if they're going to take anything from the Black Lives Matter movement, it's they need more black people, more ethnic people in positions of authority. Because all these decisions to remove TV shows like Fawlty Towers and all the rest of it, you know those decisions aren't being taken by black people. Black people would never do that. That's somebody with white guilt trying to make the situation better and inevitably making it worse. Because, you know, it just makes, you know, white British people feel that their culture's under attack. Whereas, you know, it might be under attack, but it's from white liberal wokeness. It's not under attack from anybody else. So, yeah, they need, like, more black people in positions of authority because they won't be burdened with white guilt. So I might have a chance of getting on the TV. But yeah, I think the BBC, for it to succeed, you know, considering it charges a licence fee, I mean, to people who are daft enough to... I haven't paid licence fee in about 15 years. I don't know why anybody would pay it. But it's easy. You see, they came to my door once. They came to my door. And I knew it was going to be them. And I just answered the door in my underpants. I was all hungover. My hair was a mess. I answered the door in my underpants. They're like, you don't have a TV licence? I was like, oh yeah, I only use the TV for, like, I plug it into the laptop. Come in and have a look. And they were like, nah, I'll just tick on the form. That, like, so that's how you get out of paying your TV licence. Just answer the door in your pants.
I tell you what, very quickly, if we've got time, do either of you have an idea who would make a good Director General of the BBC?
Patrick Hutchinson.
Straight out of the gate, there you go.
And he'd sling the BBC over his shoulder and save it.
Carry it to safety.
Don't over-intellectual. Like, just do stuff that's the right thing to do. Try it out, you know, do the right thing in the moment. That's good enough. That would be a massive improvement.
Well, Leo, it's been a real pleasure having you here on That Slide.
Thanks
so much.
Me.
Thanks a lot. And you're free now to go into the not freedom that is the UK and not Australia. I'm so sorry about that. Now, if you like what you've heard, you can follow Leo on Twitter, at LeoKiss. You can also follow Andy and I, too, although not too close. Andy Shaw 1 and at Benedict Spence. Well, that's all from us. Join us next time for more statue shaming and other events of book burning and general rigmarole here on That's Life. Cheerio.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.